Good morning. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show, and we start today with a look at Swedish cuisine. Now, perhaps for many, when you think first thing that comes to mind, top of mind for Swedish food might come from a big box furniture store, which might be strange, or it may come from the Swedish pancakes in Door County, as it does for me. But I'd be interested in knowing from you what Swedish food means to you and what your favorite Swedish dish may be, because we have the author of a new cookbook out today, and it is called simply The Swedish Cookbook. Niklas Ekstedt is a Michelin star chef, a restaurateur, cookbook author, and again, his latest is out today, The Swedish Cookbook. And if you have questions for him about Swedish cuisine, join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And Chef Niklas, welcome to The Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you.
It is a pleasure to have you because I have enjoyed your cookbook over the weekend. I have tried a couple of dishes that we'll get to in a bit. But for it's just so much fun for me. But for starters, and partly because I'm not a great chef, I don't consider myself a good cook, but I feel like I made some amazing dishes from your book. So
thank you.
Thank you, Niklas. Let's start with a little bit of the basics. How would you describe Swedish cuisine?
Well, Swedish cooking is kind of like, well, now you think of Scandinavia as this very rich and prosperous part of Europe. But once, you know, Sweden was one of the poorest countries in Europe 150 years ago. That's why there's so many Swedish people in America. We migrated like the Irish and the Scottish. So a lot of Swedish people, I mean, I think 20-30% of the population went to the US, actually.
Wow.
And because there was poverty here. So a lot of the Swedish food was out, and it's very cold climate, harsh part of Europe. So, I mean, a lot of Swedish food and Scandinavian cooking in general comes out of a necessity and surviving the long winters. So there's a lot of preservation. I think the best thing to describe it is gravad lax, cured salmon. It's actually, you cure the salmon with a lot of salt and a lot of sugar. So it's supposed to have a long shelf life and last for a long time. So I think, yeah, originally surviving, I would say, to describe food.
That doesn't necessarily come through in your cookbook, though. To me, it seems like a lot of simple flavors brought forward in a way that features, you know, the natural ingredients.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the way it has turned into the modern Swedish food, has that depth of fermented food, preserved, pickling, salted. And then because we nowadays, you know, have supermarkets and it's a very, you know, enjoy vegetables, we kind of like add that old style of cooking but with a bit of freshness to it. So like salad or some vegetables or a good sauce or something. So it's very much a very fresh and very nutritious diet and cuisine.
So here's a simple one I tried from the Swedish cookbook over the weekend and just loved it, and we'll be having it again. And it is so simple, Niklas. Cabbage salad with blueberries and shaved frozen feta. It really is just shaved cabbage, thinly shaved, and then you put a nice lemon and olive oil on it, and then you top it with blueberries, you shave off some frozen feta, add some salt and pepper, and you've got a delicious dish that has acid, it has sweetness, and it has the saltiness of the feta, and it really all comes forward because it's really all there is.
Yeah, and it goes so well with pretty much anything. You can eat it with meat or with fish, or, you know, even with a burger you can have it. So it's great. It's amazing. It's actually, I'm so happy you cook. I didn't know that you'd cook that. It's actually, I'm so happy you did it because it's my kid's favorite side.
Yes.
So I do that at least once a week for the kids, because you got all that vitamins from like blueberries, and you got the pepper, and it's still quite, you know, rich salad that has the cabbage. So it's not only leaves, it's actually fills you up a little bit. And cabbage is like one of those things. Today, when vegetables are so expensive, cabbage is still quite cheap.
And yet in the realm of, I would say, American cuisine, where you have the burgers and the fries and such, you wouldn't necessarily think of a combination of blueberries, cabbage, lemon, and feta. But when you put that all together, it really brings forward everything you'd want out of the taste of a dish.
Yes. Yeah. And the frozen feta just makes it like cold and salty and fat. Well, which is really nice.
It's like salty ice cream on top.
Yeah. Yeah. Chef, and also the feta cheese has a longer longevity. I mean, a longer shelf life if you put it in the freezer as well. So you can keep it for a longer time as well.
So Chef Nicholas, tell us a little bit about your history and what brought you to your love of your native cuisine.
I was raised in the mountains in a ski resort, like the most exclusive ski resort in Sweden called like Åre. So it's a little bit like equivalent to Aspen in America.
Sure.
My parents did summer activities there. So they ran a small business, took people out on the rivers, like whitewater rafting and, you know, these type of like tourist activities. So they ran that business. My mother was a teacher. My dad was like that small entrepreneur. And I was raised in a very small, simple village out in the mountains on the Norwegian border. My parents moved down south, and there was a boarding school in my village or the close by town, which had a culinary school. Mm. And so I wanted to stay with my friends and where I was raised. And so I ended up studying at a culinary boarding school at the age of 15. Wow. And so I never really thought of cooking to be my career. I just did it because, it was the only way I could stay with my friends. And then when I was in third year in culinary school, we got a new teacher from Stockholm, and he was really ambitious with me. And I think he saw some type of talent in me, though I was very didn't pay much attention in school. He saw that I could cook. So he took me under his arms, and eventually I ended up in the United States in 1997 in Chicago.
Sort of like, so you continued your cuisine in Chicago, but Chicago, you think of like Italian beefs and you think of Chicago style hot dogs.
Yes. But the thing was, why I ended up in Chicago in the 90s was because there was one of the most famous restaurants in the world was in Chicago at that time. It was called Charlotte Trotters. And so my culinary teacher, he had a connection to the restaurant because he knew a guy that used to work there. So he helped me out to get an internship. And he said, I have a young talent, Swedish chef that I want to send abroad. I want him to learn high cuisine, but he can't speak French or Spanish. So he didn't want to send me to Southern Europe. So he sent me to the United States. And at that time, actually, there was a big Swedish community still in Chicago, although it was kind of like the last generation of it. So I stayed within a lady that ran the Swedish church in Chicago. So I stayed at this old second or third generation Swedish immigrants in her house. And I stayed there for free as long as I washed her hair once a week on Sunday.
that is fascinating.
And she still spoke Swedish, though with a very old school dialect. But she was very happy because her parents died many, many, many years ago. So it was a way to practice her Swedish. So I stayed at her house and worked at a high-end restaurant in Chicago. And that's where I was trained pretty much. And then Chef Trotter kept me as a mentor, for almost the rest of my career.
Did you ever make it up to Wisconsin where we are?
I did. I've been, beautiful. I mean, amazing. Also a lot of Swedish history there as well.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of cheese.
that as well.
There, you mentioned gravad lax, the cured salmon. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but as part of Swedish tradition. But there's a couple other Swedish terms that go into cooking that may help explain, you know, the where the cuisine comes from and where it takes you as well. Fika, am I saying that right? Fika?
Yeah, so important for Swedes. It's like, as soon as you say that word, people like relax. Because it pretty much means coffee break. The important thing with the fika is it can be pretty much anything as long as you don't do anything and you drink coffee and you eat something with the coffee. It can be a pancake, a cinnamon bun, or some candy, but it needs to be, the coffee needs to be eaten with something sweet.
See, I think an American coffee break means you make it to the break room, you fill up your coffee cup, and then you go back to in front of your computer screen.
Yeah, that would be a no-no in Sweden. You're not supposed to look at your phone. You're also supposed to talk about something that's not very important. You're not allowed to talk about politics or about if your kids have a problem. You're just supposed to talk about fun things, natural things, have a conversation that's light, and enjoy your coffee. Yeah.
And that is the last, that is the name of the last chapter of your book, which features over 80 recipes, but it makes sense when you explain what a cozy coffee break is, this fika, the recipes that are in that chapter.
Yes, it's religion in Sweden. The fika culture is very, very deep.
Yeah. It's religion. Here's another term, Swedish term, that goes to the heart of Swedish cooking. Lagom? Am I saying that right?
Yeah. The word lagom comes from the whole team. So lag is team and om is the whole. So it means that for the whole team. So it's, if you cook something, it's supposed to be enough for everyone and not too much and not too little. It's supposed to be enough. Yeah.
The whole team, lagom.
Yeah, the whole team. Yeah, for the whole team.
So this all creates a Swedish cuisine that is, you could describe as simple and balanced, that also takes into account Swedish history and making food last as long as possible, available for everybody. And the Swedish religion of getting away, taking a break, and, relaxing.
Yes, that's it. I mean, the thing is that Swedes are really good at it. It's like really connecting through food and talking and being together is very important.
We're already way beyond Swedish meatballs. Not that there isn't a recipe for that in your book, Niklas. So I think, you know, beginning to understand where this food comes from, where the culture takes you, and what the tastes represent as part of it all. Our guest is Chef Niklas Ekstedt, a Michelin star chef, restaurateur, and his latest cookbook is out today, simply called The Swedish Cookbook. And if you've got your favorite recipes, your favorite dishes from Sweden, or your favorite stories, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Our conversation continues with Chef Niklas next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Chef Niklas Ekstedt, our guest on The Larry Mueller Show. His new book out today, The Swedish Cookbook, featuring over 80 recipes, some simple and some that you would have to work at, but that work is well worthwhile, as we'll get to, as the other recipe that I got to try. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or talk@wpr.org. And Chef Niklas, I understand that you opened a restaurant in Stockholm back in 2011 that featured raw ingredients cooked over an open fire. What was the open? And I think of this because of the temperature that you I baked the cardamom buns with at 475 degrees, which I thought was a little hot until I tried it. How important is this open fire to Swedish cooking?
Swedish cooking is all like originally based on the birch fire, so it has a very deep culture within fire, cast iron, offset smoker, and that balance is super important for old school Swedish cooking, and that's why I decided to go old style. 15, 16 years ago, when I opened my own restaurant, I just wanted to, go back in history and research it, and then bring these old style recipes back to life in a contemporary restaurant. So it's not like my restaurant is a museum. It's just like, it's just that the cooking is that the kitchen is like a kitchen was 200-300 years ago in Stockholm.
And how would I replicate that in my own kitchen?
Well, it's kind of difficult indoors.
So a grill, maybe?
It's a lot of smoke, but you can go outdoors, definitely. Yeah. It's pretty simple. I mean, you think of it almost like a cowboy fire. So it's like just an open fire with with wood, and then a cast iron pan in the middle of it. And then you season the fire with either some juniper or apple wood, or you just use the fire and the heat and the heat from the cast iron. So it's like, it's not grilling because it's like live fire cooking. So it's a little different from like Texas barbecue. But I do also use a lot some of the smoking techniques as well. But the base of my cooking is kind of like open fire and then just stick in the cast iron pan straight into the fire.
So I had a difficult time finding lingonberries at my local grocery store, Chef Nicholas. And as I understand, there is a substitute that you could use in lieu of lingonberries if you are trying out Swedish pancakes from your recipe book or the big pancake from your recipe book. What could we use if we can't find lingonberries in Wisconsin?
I guess you can get cranberries, right?
Yeah, they are everywhere here. So
yeah, they're everywhere. So they're pretty similar, not identical, but. But you can also buy it at the Swedish furniture store, the big one with yellow and blue signs.
Yes, as the Swedish meatballs as well. But do you, as a Michelin star chef, have a review of the big box furniture store's meatballs?
Well, there are like for an American, there would be burgers and there would be burgers, right? You can enjoy a cheap, simple burger, and then you can make your homemade burger. That's not, you know, they're not the same thing. So I guess that's the same thing for Swedish people. I do sometimes eat meatballs at the furniture store, but it's not like the homemade one. That's better. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Sometimes I go to a fast food restaurant to grab a burger on the fly. Yeah. But how is your Swedish meatball recipe in the Swedish cookbook? How did you come up with that? And where do those tastes, flavors, and profiles come from?
Yeah, so the old way of making Swedish meatballs, the original recipe, was something that you had for like Christmas or like a wedding, or it was something that takes a little longer time, mm-hmm. and it's a little more, there's some different steps in it, but it's really worth doing at least once in your lifetime to eat real Swedish meatballs. So it contains like three different types of meat. In my recipe, there's veal, beef, and pork, but you can also use game meat. The most important thing is that you mix two types or three, preferably three types of different meat, and then you mince them finely, and then you mix them with breadcrumbs and cream into a very moist texture. Because actually, in Swedish, a köttbulle is actually not a meatball, it's a meat bun. Huh. So it's supposed to be like a mixture of breadcrumbs, creams, chopped onions, and minced meat. So it becomes almost like a dough more than like Italian meatballs. And then when you have them, you fry them in a little bit of oil and a little bit of butter, and the texture is softer, lighter, and way more rich than an Italian meatball.
My maternal grandmother used to make Swedish meatballs every Christmas, and it was something we all looked for. It was like her gift to us every Christmas, because it was something you had to work at. It was something you had to go look for to get the ground veal and the different types of meat. And it was something you had to hand make each meatball and then, you know, fry them up. And it was just such a labor of love. But the thing was, and I think we can all relate to this in my family, you could taste that.
Yeah, you remember it, right?
Yes.
It's like memory, yeah. It is something very special if you put the effort into it and make them the original way. I do it like maybe a couple of three, four times a year for my family, and it's always the highlight of like the culinary year. My kids go mental when they hear that I'm doing it. Because I don't know, there's something with the fat, the juiciness, the texture and the butter, and the mashed potatoes and the lingonberries, it's just like so delicious.
Decadent. I think that's the word that comes to mind.
Yeah, it's why it's so popular. Even the cheap version, the fast food version, is so popular. It's because it's like the Scandinavian cheeseburger. It's like...
Yeah, but I don't know, you know, I don't know anyone that would take that much time to make a cheeseburger. This is you know, this takes some work to put into it, but you can taste that work and the difference it makes in the end result. My mom has tried to make Swedish meatballs on a number of occasions and for Christmas and a celebration, but it is a lot of work. And I think maybe we could all use a little help. And I look forward to trying this recipe. I didn't have time to procure all the meats this time around, but it is on my list. And you mentioned the cream that goes into your Swedish meatball, Chef Nicholas. Dalla emailed that for 5 decades now, her family has always had Swedish cream for their Christmas Eve dessert. She says it's incredibly rich and they always eat it in just a little small bowl with a spoon. Swedish cream?
Yeah, I mean, I think what she's referring to is kind of like a cream sauce, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty much gravy and cream that you cook together and you eat it with meat and with meatballs.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds like the sort of what we have on top of our Swedish meatballs from my grandma.
Exactly.
The other food that comes to Swedish food that comes to mind comes from Door County, Wisconsin, with a restaurant that has the goats on the roofs and the Swedish pancakes that people travel across states to find. And you have a Swedish pancake recipe in your book, and I found it so simple. So why do Swedish pancakes taste so good? Why would people travel past pancake houses and waffle houses to get to a Swedish pancake in Wisconsin, Chef Nicholas?
Well, I haven't been to the pancake house in Wisconsin, but it sounds like I need to go immediately. But the thing is that Swedish pancakes are thinner, and they're they don't have any baking soda in it. It's just like cream, flour, milk, flour, and eggs.
It's so simple.
So simple, and they need to be very thin. And the most important thing, they're cooked in butter, and so it's a crepe. A French crepe is a little thinner. The Swedish pancake is a little thicker, but it's something I make in the mornings on Sundays, usually for my kids. But I have this very, very simple little trick how to make them.
Yes.
And it's just to use a jar. So you put like the eggs, the flour, and the milk in a jar, and then you just shake the jar. So you don't even need a whisk. You don't even need like a bowl. You just shake that jar with the milk and the eggs and the flour in it. And then in the frying pan, you have butter and a little bit of oil.
Okay.
So not only butter, because the butter burns at quickly.
Sure.
But gives it flavor, and the oil can take a little more heat. So if you mix a little bit of butter and milk in the pan, and then you pour the batter in, and then you just make a thin pancake on that. It's simple, much simpler than the Swedish meatballs.
Anyone, yes.
Anyone can make Swedish pancake. Anyone.
Chef Nicholas, Jeff emailed to ask if Swedish cuisine is considered to be as healthy as, say, the Mediterranean diet. He says his grandparents were from Sweden, and as you mentioned, they seem to use a lot of salt and other ingredients that may not have been the most heart healthy, but it was usually quite hearty and tasty.
Yeah. No, of course. I mean, if you look at the blue zones or like longevity in Europe, usually you have Mediterranean islands that live the longest, but in Scandinavia, men and women live very, very long. So we have the highest longevity when it comes both men and women. Usually in around the Mediterranean are the women that live the longest, but we have, but I think it's the Mediterranean cooking is all about olive oil and, wheat and pasta and meat and a little bit of fish, while the Swedish and Scandinavian cuisine is more butter, fat fish like salmon and herring, and more fermented and pickled food. So it's a little it's very, very, very different types of cuisine, the Mediterranean, the Swedish, but of course it's still very healthy.
Our guest is Chef Nicholas Ekstedt, a Michelin star chef, restaurateur. His latest cookbook is out today. It is simply called The Swedish Cookbook, with over 80 pages of recipes, detailed instructions, as well as some beautiful pictures of Swedish food that takes you from the vegetables to the meats to the fika, and which is the cozy coffee break foods. That's the last chapter. And if you want to join the conversation with your favorite Swedish dish or a question about Swedish cuisine or pancakes, cakes. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. And as you mentioned before, Chef Nicholas, if we don't have lingonberries around but still want to have that Swedish pancake experience or have it with our Swedish meatballs, cranberries in Wisconsin would be a viable alternative.
Yes, very much so.
What are some of the seasonings that Swedish cuisine uses? Because outside of salt and pepper, I really, you know, did not see a lot of ornate seasoning profiles.
No, I mean, Swedish cooking is not very spicy. It has saltiness, acidity from vinegar and sometimes lemon juice, but that's something modern. But, I mean, when we... And the spices that you get in Swedish cuisine is horseradish. That's like, that's how spicy it gets. Like, my kids are used to spicy food because, of course, nowadays we have cuisine from all over the world. But when I was a kid and was, you know, being raised in rural Sweden in the 80s, we did not have any foreign foods. So I had my first spicy food as a young adult. When I came to the U.S., was the first time I had spicy Indian food or chilies and all of that. And of course, I enjoy it. But the Swedish cuisine itself, the richness is in the product itself. As you can see in the book, it's like a lot of like freshness. It's a lot about like having the game meat and then frying it in a good temperature or baking something or enhancing the flavors with the cooking itself or the technical aspect of the cooking.
Yeah, and so then the salt and the pepper is just basically used to bring out the best of these ingredients to make those ingredients what's front forward in these recipes.
Exactly. And also the cast iron itself, when you're cooking it, it enhances and enriches the product that you're cooking. So that's why I said, like, you can boil or blanch your vegetables or whatever you're cooking, and then kind of like frying it and adding flavor from the butter and or salt and pepper, and also adding like richness from like two types of acidity. So like in a lot of Swedish cuisine in general, it's you usually add vinegar and maybe another type of acidity as well. So you can add like lemon juice. And what happens to the food, that if you have two types of acidity in it, it actually, something magical happens and it enhances and it tastes even better.
I have an email here from Grant who asks if you have a favorite Swedish yeast bread recipe that he could try.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, Grant. I think this, I mean, like you mentioned the cardamom and the cinnamon buns, but I mean, the sweet yeast buns, I mean, are just so good. I mean, I walked the streets earlier today in Stockholm, and you can see how the tourists go absolutely nuts when they go into the Swedish bakeries to get all the pastries there. They're like, it's different. They're so rich and so delicious and far from, anything else. So yeah, I think try a cinnamon or a cardamom bun. Yeah.
The very last recipe in your book out today, the Swedish cookbook, is the cardamom buns. And it is the other recipe that I tried this weekend. And usually when I try recipes, I bring them into work and share them with the coworkers so they can validate my cooking or whatever. Chef Nicholas, these cardamom buns did not make it to work. They stayed at home and we enjoyed them all.
And finished, yeah.
This is an amazing, again, it takes some time to put into work, to knead the dough, let it rise, and then, you know, shape it out and then let it rise again. But it is such a simple recipe that brings forward the yeasty rolls. It's not overpowering with sugar. It's not super sweet at all, but it has a sweetness to it. And that cardamom, it fills the kitchen with it made the kitchen smell beautiful. And I ate them, well, me and my family ate them all before they could make it to work today, with apologies to Jeff Robbins.
Yeah, well, I get that, because there's something with, you know, I don't know what it is, but with, I don't know why it's not more commonly used.
Yes.
Cardamom. It's because something, it's spice that works so well with sweet dish. You know, it's kind of like it punches everything up a little bit. And also what's really good, you were, You made a very, very good point there. What's great with cardamom is that you can add that to a sweet pastry dish or a dessert, and still you don't need to use as much sugar because it tastes sweeter. And so it's a great way to reduce the amount of sugar that you need for a recipe, but still enhance a lot of flavor with cardamom.
Yeah, seriously, there is 3 tablespoons of sugar, I think, in the dough, and then a 1/3 cup for the filling. But that was the extent of sugar, which when you compare it to a cinnamon roll in the United States, that's barely nothing.
Yeah, it's and something you can do to even to make it even more if you have is to roast the cardamom a little bit before crushing it, if you get whole cardamom, which is a great way to like make it even like punch even more. But no, those cardamom buns are like
little egg wash.
It's a very local thing. So it's a very local thing for the city of Stockholm. Wow. And because I'm raised in northern Sweden, we didn't have cardamom buns as a kid. So I remember the first time I had one of those buns was my grandma. She took me to a famous place here in Stockholm where they bake those cardamom buns, and I can still remember like so vividly. Like when I was probably 8, 9 years old and I had the first chew on that.
Yeah, we were looking for maybe doing Swedish pancakes this weekend, but it looks like we're going to go back to the cardamom buns once again. And maybe
why is someone making a chain of cardamom bun cafes all over the U.S.?
You've just given me a great idea, Chef Nicholas. Let's get to your calls next here with our guest, Chef Nicholas Ekstedt. His new book is The Swedish Cookbook, out today, which wraps up with that cardamom bun recipe. Janet in Columbus, Ohio, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Hi, what do you have for us?
Well, I'm so enthralled by your program because I'm a big fan of these cuisines. But I have a question. My family has been making Swedish meatballs for generations, and we put in ginger, nutmeg, and allspice, just a little. And I didn't know if we've been violating a law of Swedish cuisine, or is that legitimate?
Ginger, nutmeg, and allspice in Swedish meatballs, Chef Nicholas.
Yes, it's absolutely correct. It's something that you eat for Christmas. So like these dry Asian spices like ginger and nutmeg was something that was very, very expensive back in the days in Scandinavia. So to treat your family, it's been a family tradition to spice up the meatballs for Christmas. So it's an old tradition of showing respect to your family members and eating something that's very exclusive for Christmas. So nutmeg and ginger spice is so you've been eating Christmas meatballs.
Perfect, Janet. Thank you so much for adding that to the list. Let's go to Catherine and Stevens Point next. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My great grandparents were from southern Sweden, and one of the recipes that's continued in our family are some sugar cookies, and they are leavened with hartshorn, which is baking ammonia, and I think was originally derived from the ash of burned horns of either deer or sheep. So when making this cookie dough, the whole kitchen will be permeated with the smell of ammonia, which is not attractive, but the cookies have an incredible light, crisp crunch. And I always have found that interesting, and people find it so strange when I tell them what the secret ingredient is in, because they're really quite unusual in their flavor and their crispness. The other comment I have is one technique that I've heard that I think comes from Sweden, if not just generally Scandinavia, is to bake cookie dough flat in long cylinders, bake it, and then cut it into bars. And that way they could have all 7 kinds of cookies that was evidently traditional for the tea that they would have later in the day when they would have friends over.
Their fika.
Yes. I mean, both are correct stories and are very deeply rooted in southern Swedish traditions of cooking. So the first cookie you mentioned is called a dröm. It actually means dream. And the baking powder you mentioned as well is also correct. It's the secret ingredients in drömmar, in dreams. And that cookie, you can also add jam on top in the very end if you want to add it a little bit of acidity to it. And then it's called the Raspberry Dream. And the second one you mentioned is called the Snittar, which means a cut cookie. And the cut cookie is very, very popular and is something that is eaten all over Sweden. And the seven cookies it's very culturally deep culture in the fika culture. And if you're going to have for a Sunday, if you had all your friends over, you're supposed to serve them seven different types of cookies. That's kind of like the peak of fika. So yeah, very, very correct Swedish traditions that are very old, and I'm so happy to hear that they're still around on the other side of the Atlantic. So thank you very much for that.
Dalla emailed back. She had that Swedish cream. She says it's like a thick custard with sour cream, heavy cream, and sugar. She's also seen the recipe called Danish cream, and she tops it with raspberries.
Yes. Okay, so that's a sweet one that you serve with berries. That's correct. That's a pastry. So you mix... You mix cream with a little bit of creme fraiche, and then you add lemon zest to it.
Chef Nicholas Ekstedt, I want to thank you so much for taking us to a world of flavors and taking us back in time and taking me back into my kitchen with that cardamom smell from the cardamom buns, which is the last recipe of among 80 in your new cookbook, the Swedish cookbook. Chef Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been... Yeah, you do. Amazing. Thank you very much.
I agree. I feel
it's so fun to hear that the Swedish traditions are still alive in the United States, and it makes me happy. I'm going to have a great night.
The pleasure has been all ours, Chef Nicholas Ekstedt, Michelin star chef, restaurateur, and check out the new cookbook, the Swedish cookbook. When we continue, we celebrate 50 years of Old World Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.